Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Former Major League pitcher Tommy John is the picture of perseverance. They said he couldn't win at the Major League level because he couldn't throw heat. People started tinkering with his motion. He suffered bone chips. He separated his shoulder. Then one day during a game, something went pop, and what could have been the beginning of the end of his career became the beginning of the extension not only of his career, but a lot of other careers as well. Tommy John will be the luncheon speaker at MTSU's annual Baseball Literature Conference March 30th in the James Union Building. He's our guest today on MTSU on the Record, but first, MTSUNews.com gives us its best pitch.
Here's the latest from MTSUNews.com, the university's news and information website. With the first anniversary of the March 11th nuclear disaster in Fukushima, Japan, MTSU is announcing a 10-day disaster recovery education abroad and service program slated for June 2012. 10 MTSU students will witness firsthand the impact of the national disaster and participate in the cleanup and rebuilding mission. On March 14th, the presidents of MTSU and Nashville State Community College signed an agreement to make it easier for students to earn degrees from both institutions. MTSU's Dr. Sidney A. McPhee and Nashville State's Dr. George Van Allen officially authorized a concurrent enrollment and reverse transfer agreement, easing the processes between the two institutions. The VA and MTSU are entering a new partnership called Vet Success on Campus. MTSU will become the first university in Tennessee and one of only 16 nationwide to be a part of the Vet Success program. For all the latest MTSU information, go to MTSUNews.com.
Tommy John joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Tommy, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Other than the ones that you've written or co-written, what are your favorite books about baseball?
I like to read history of baseball. I think you have to know the history of the game of baseball before you can carry on with that history. You know, there's just so many good books about the 64 Cardinals and the great pennant race between the Giants and the Dodgers of 51. And, you know, I love reading those books. And I just love to read the history of the sport that I played.
Did you read Moneyball, and did you see the movie?
I read Moneyball, and I did not see the movie. And I heard the movie made Art Howe look like a bumbling idiot, and Art Howe is anything but a bumbling idiot. I've got a problem with Moneyball. Billy Beane stole it. Personally, the guy who brought Moneyball to the forefront is now the Met general manager, a guy named Sandy Alderson. Sandy Alderson was an attorney, and he was best friends with a guy named Roy Eisenhart, who was another attorney. Roy Eisenhart was the son-in-law of a guy named Walter Haas. Walter Haas was majority shareholder in Levi Strauss. They owned the Oakland A's. So Roy asked Sandy to come in and be the general manager for the A's. Sandy had no clue what baseball was about. So he told me this. He said, I came in, and I just looked at it as a trial. And so I lined up all my facts. And the one thing that I saw is the teams that stole a lot of bases didn't necessarily win pennants. So he traded Ricky Henderson, the greatest base stealer in the history of baseball. He traded him to the Yankees for about five or six young pitchers. And he found out that the teams that won had these things in common. They were at the top or near the top in pitching, defense, and runs scored. Well, that's been a staple in baseball forever. So Billy Beane is a smart person. So he took this and went farther and brought in the sabermetric people. And everybody in the game knew that on-base percentage is what you want. But you got to have somebody to drive runs in. The whole thing has gone to basically fantasy baseball. Guys that run teams are fantasy baseball players. I mean, that, you know, and they get these players according to statistics. Now, that's fine. That uncovers players, but it doesn't tell you how to make these players better. I think that sabermetrics uncovers ball players, but you still have to have people that can teach ball players and teach them how to get better.
It's always a cross between statistics and gut instinct, isn't it? I mean, neither one is completely infallible, but you have to blend the two and not rely on one or the other exclusively, right?
Exactly. You know, I'm in the business now where I work for a law firm, and we handle ball players. We're baseball agents. And, you know, so you're trying to look at ball players in high school or college, and how do you determine good players? To do the same thing, you look at their numbers, and numbers will uncover these players. Then you go watch them play, and then you see how they look on the field. I've seen guys, Jenna, with great numbers, but they can't win. They just compile good numbers, great strikeouts, no walks, low, but they make a bad pitch at the right time, and they've never figured out how to make the right pitch at the right time.
We're going to pause for a moment. When we come back, we'll talk about Tommy John's role as a medical pioneer on MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee Writing Project is a program that fosters the effective teaching of writing to students in kindergarten through high school. The Writing Project hosts annual summer institutes where teacher participants teach and learn from each other. In addition, the Writing Project sponsors summer writers' camps for youngsters. MTSU is one of 185 sites of the National Writing Project and one of only two in Tennessee. This is Dr. Bobby Solley, Project Director.
For more details, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking to former Major League pitcher Tommy John, who's going to be at the Baseball Literature Conference here at MTSU on March 30th. For you, it happened in 1974. You were with the Dodgers, and Dr. Frank Jobe replaced a ruptured ligament in your elbow with another ligament taken from your right wrist. You're a southpaw, so he operated on your right side. It was not, I understand, not revolutionary at the time for wrists and hands, but it had never been done on an elbow before, let alone an elbow that takes as much work as Major League pitcher's elbow. So tell us how hard you had to work to get back into pitching shape after the surgery.
Dr. Jobe told me that I didn't need the surgery. He said, but I can tell you this, if you do not have the surgery, you will never pitch Major League Baseball again. Well, I wanted to pitch Major League Baseball, so I wanted to have the surgery. And I knew that I would do whatever I had to do to get back. If it took me 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it would take, I could come back and pitch in the big leagues again. And back in my day, when we had it done in 74 and then I rehabbed in 75, the only way we knew then to get your arm strong, we did weights and we did this stuff, but was to throw a baseball. And that's the only way you can get your arm strong. And I still believe that 1,000,000%. If you're going to err on any one side, you err on the side of throwing. You throw to get your arm stronger. You don't go in the weight room and lift weights to make your arm stronger. It will help make it stronger, but you got to get it pitching strong, not weightlifting strong. And that's what I did. I threw a baseball 6 out of 7 days.
The thought process must have been interesting since, you know, surgery was so invasive, so much more invasive back then.
I was in the right place at the right time having Dr. Jobe operating on me. Dr. Jobe was in the right place at the right time operating on Tommy John. Between the two of us, we formed a pretty good team. And he knew that I was going to work hard enough to give it a good shot to get back. Now, people said, well, you know, it was different then than it is now. I pitched in a ball game 1 year, 1 day after surgery. 1 year, 1 day after surgery. And that's pretty much right on what guys do now. Maybe somebody might be a month earlier or a month or two later or whatever, but generally it's a year, but you don't get the fineness back until about 18 months. I didn't get my pitching back to where I could pitch when I didn't have my really good stuff until about halfway through the 1976 season. About second half of the season, I started to get to the point where I didn't have my good stuff, but I knew I knew I could pitch and I knew I could win.
And when your ligament snapped, Dr. Job said, didn't he, that it wasn't any one thing, but it was just a cumulative effect of a lot of things over time, wasn't it?
He said it's kind of like getting a pot of water on the stove and you start putting pebbles in. Well, can you tell me which pebble is it going to be that's going to make the water overflow? No. And he said basically that's what happened to your arm. But the other thing that happened is I hurt my elbow going from Little League to Babe Ruth League, going from 46 feet to 60 feet. And my 13-year-old year in Babe Ruth ball, I did not pitch, so I played first base the entire year. And I was fine for the rest of high school, American Legion ball and all that. And then when I started pitching every 4 days in pro baseball after graduating from high school, all of a sudden, you know, I started getting tender elbow. Between 1963 and 1974, 11 years, I probably had 50, 60 cortisone injections in my elbow. And Dr. Job said that, coupled with the wear and tear of pitching, did me in.
At different points during your career, Early Wynn, who was a Hall of Fame pitcher and later a pitching coach, tried to adjust your style, and then Johnny Sain, another Hall of Fame pitcher who became a pitching coach, tried to adjust your style. But there's no one-size-fits-all coaching for pitchers, is it? It has to be highly tailored to the individual and what they put on the table, right?
I tell you, I had a friend of mine that ended up being a baseball coach and athletic director at Morehead State, a guy named Steve Hamilton. He told me my first spring training, 1962, he said, you're going to have coaches that are going to be there, and they're going to see you and say, oh, you should be doing this. Oh, you should be doing that. Oh, you should be doing this. He said, you want to be courteous and say, okay, and try it. If you can use it, fine. If you can't use it, fine. I probably had a reputation in baseball as being hard-headed, stubborn, uncoachable. And I apologize to Johnny Sain. All Johnny wanted me to do was throw more. And I was always of the opinion that there's only so many bullets in the gun on your shoulder, and you had to save ammunition. Well, then when I hurt my arm and to come back on the rehabilitation, I threw every day, or 6 out of 7 days. And I found the more I threw, the better my arm felt.
At any point in your career, did you ever consider going from the rotation to the bullpen to extend your career?
Well, Walt Alston asked me doing that after my first or second year with the Dodgers, and I said, yeah, I'll go to the bullpen. I said, but I got to have a 6-year contract. And he said, what? You know, we don't give those out. And I said, well, you want to take me out of what I've been doing my entire career, so it's going to take me at least 1 year to get acclimated to the bullpen. And then I give you 3 or 4 good years in the bullpen, and then you give me 1 bonus year from pitching me 80, 90, 100 games out of the bullpen. And that's, Tommy, here's a year on your contract. Thank you very much for doing what you did. At the end of my career, when the Yankees released me, I sent videos out to about 5 or 6 ball clubs that I thought I could help. And my statement to them was, I don't have to start. I can pitch out of the bullpen. And I said, I think I would be very effective out of the bullpen because, one, I sink the ball and I throw strikes and I can pitch every day. And those three things. But, you know, at 46, you had a lot of people that were just reluctant to pull the trigger on bringing in a guy that's 46 years of age.
We'll take another break, and we'll be back in just a moment. More of Tommy John on MTSU on the Record right after this.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Tommy John, who is going to be the luncheon speaker at MTSU's annual baseball literature conference on March 30th in the James Union Building. I opened by saying that you were the picture of perseverance and your ability to withstand a certain amount of familial pain is part of that. I remember back in 1981 reading about what happened to your son Travis when he fell out of a window and landed on the bumper of a car. If I remember correctly, didn't your wife Sally pry his mouth open with a bottle of nail polish?
Yeah, she was. They were visiting friends at the Jersey Shore, and that was before Snooki was there.
Thank goodness.
And thank God. And they were getting ready to go out that night, and she was doing her nails, and the boys were in their room. And it was a real, real, real old house, and they had these low sills, window sills, about a foot off the ground. And Travis was sitting there bouncing against the screen, and the screen pulled loose, and he tumbled out. And Tommy, my son Tommy, went in and told his sister. He said, "Damn, Mom's really going to be mad at Travis. He just fell out the window." And then my daughter, being a future Duke graduate, and you know she had enough common sense that she's yelling, you know, "Help, help, help, help!" And my wife went running out, and she found that she had the old nail polish when you had the real long cuticle sticks on the end of the top, and she pried his mouth open and popped his tongue out and got him breathing. And I was in Detroit at the time, and I was just throwing in the bullpen when I got the call that he had fallen, and she said that he was dying. And so I chartered a plane from a friend of mine in Detroit and flew back in. And Travis he was in a coma for 17 days, and he was in the hospital for 30. And at the end of about 30 days, he walked out of the hospital, and the doctor said, "You know, we can tell you that this was going to happen, but it was going to happen in a longer time frame. So whomever you're praying to and whatever you're saying in those prayers, I would keep it up, because there is no medical reason as to why he got as well as he did, as fast as he did." You know, he's a 33-year-old husband, father of one, and he works for Dick's Sporting Goods, and he is a very, very, very good young man.
Your son Taylor, who died in 2010, your youngest son, he struggled with depression.
Right.
Tell me how he fought that monster.
Well, you know, he was on Broadway. In fact, if you go up to Nashville and you go into TPAC, Tennessee Performing Arts Center, you will see a picture of Taylor John. He was the first person that had their picture painted and hung in TPAC. He came through in the Broadway play Les Miserables. And as he got older, he sounds like Josh Groban. I mean, the kid could do illusion. He could do card magic, table magic. He could tell jokes. He could make everybody laugh, and the room would light up. And his voice was tremendous. He never thought he was worthy of all the talents that God gave him. And he battled it and battled it and battled it. And it wasn't a matter of if he was going to kill himself. It was just when, because the time that he died, that was his fourth attempt. I was out in Southern California going to a trade show, and I got the voicemail at about 5:15 in the morning that he had passed away. And he was a remarkable young man, and I just keep telling him all the time, you know, keep practicing your golf game, because I'm on the back nine of my life, and we'll be together someday up there playing golf in heaven.
Probably with my friend Jim Huber, who passed away earlier this year, too. How do you endure an experience like that? Is it faith? Is it the stubbornness you talked about earlier? Is it togetherness?
Well, I think no matter what you do, you have to have faith. Faith in anything. Me, I have faith in God that whatever is going to be out there might not be what we have in mind right now, but it's what God had in mind for us. And I think stubbornness, stick-to-itiveness, being the hard-headed person, seeing things through. But I think it's also having a sphere of friends that pick you up and dust you off and tell you how much that they love you, and to get you through the down times. I know after the funeral, the company I was working for was Spurtable Scoreboards out of Murray, Kentucky, and they said, you know, take as much time off as you want. And I said, I don't want any time off. I said, I want to work, and I want you to work me twice as hard, twice as much as you have in the past. Because the more I kept going, the easier it was for me to deal, because I didn't have time to sit and think. If I took time off, I would have just sat and thought about Taylor and how bad it was and all this, and I just kept going. And that was, I don't know if that's right or it's wrong, but that was right for Tommy John.
Tommy John is our guest, Ben. We'll be back after this.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
Continuing our conversation with former Major League pitcher Tommy John, whose revolutionary surgery in 1974 literally changed the game of baseball forever. When you look at how steroids has changed the game, changed the record books, put a cloud over Major League Baseball, what's your take on it?
The first time I'd ever heard of anybody doing steroids was in 83, 84 when I was with the Angels. And I said, really? You're kidding. Somebody would take that? And, you know, it's just, I was shocked that, well, I don't know how many names on there tested positive, but I would swear that there would be more pitchers on the list than hitters. Because you can take steroids until your testicles look like Lesueur peas, and it's not going to make you a better hitter. It'll only make you a stronger hitter. You have to be able to hit the ball to begin with. But as a pitcher, you take it. All of a sudden, you're a mediocre, half-ass pitcher, and you throw the ball, and you add about 6-8 miles an hour onto your fastball. Now, all of a sudden, you're a stud. Still doesn't make any difference if you can win. It just means you can throw the ball 96, 98 miles an hour. God, this guy can pitch, but he can't get anybody out, but he can pitch. So you can stay around the game, and I just was shocked that more pitchers were not caught doing steroids or HGH than what was out there, or what we know about.
Ryan Braun's suspension for elevated levels of testosterone, as you know, was overturned by an arbitrator, the first such occurrence in Major League history. Braun's attorney alleges that the person who collected his urine sample could have tainted the sample by taking it home with him instead of FedExing it on to the testing lab where it should have been. And of course, the collector says that he didn't want it to sit in the FedEx office over the weekend because he took the sample on a Saturday. Is Ryan Braun ever going to be clean in the court of public opinion? And
no,
and should
never.
Should the testing regimen be reexamined and changed?
When you are tested, a doctor watches you pee into a bottle. You take it, or the doctor takes it and pours equal amounts into a container. You, as the player, take a top and you put it on both containers. Then the doctor sits there while you're watching him, and he seals it with like this paraffin over the top of it. So if that paraffin's not broken, nobody got into that sucker. Then you, as the ball player, put it into two or three baggies and seal it. And then you sign off on it. The doctor signs off on it. They put it into a pouch or a container, and it goes to the collector who is there. Now, the collector, if he would have taken it to FedEx, and Braun's people said that there was a FedEx open at, it was 5 miles. That's true. It was. But going to Montreal, the sample would not have gotten out until Monday morning. All Ryan Braun had to do was, when that came out, say, hey, I'll take it again. I'll pee in a bottle right now. Let's take it again right now. But he never offered that. If he would have done that, I think everybody would have said, hey, this guy's on the up and up. He's clean. He never offered to do anything to rectify the wrong. In Braun's defense, now, I'm going to tell you, in his defense, as much as he works out and as much steroid and testosterone that was in his body, he does not have a steroid body.
What about the future of the game? Will it ever get out from under the steroid cloud, and will that stench ever leave the sport?
No, I think that it will always be there, but you just go on and plug along and do what you've got to do. And you know, it's kind of like pro football now with the bounty. You know, next year somebody is going to put a lick on some running back or some quarterback or some end going across the middle, and they will put a lick on him and the guy won't get up. And I know they will say, oh, I wonder if there's a bounty on him. And the same thing in football and baseball. They've got the thing now. Guy hits home runs. Well, I wonder if he's on the juice. Oh, I wonder if he has a bounty on those guys. It's something that happened, and you just got to go on and hope people forget down the way.
You have 288 career wins. 164 of them, according to my math, came after the surgery. All of your 20-plus win seasons, came post-surgery.
Right.
And yet your eligibility for the Hall of Fame has elapsed unless the Veterans Committee comes through. Do you think they'll vote you in?
Yeah, I think somewhere down the line. If they do, I just hope I'm cognizant and clear-headed enough that I can make my speech, that somebody won't have to make the speech for me. But truthfully, and this is the God's honest truth, if I get voted in, I will feel better about it getting voted in by my peers than I would by sports writers who never saw me pitch.
Because a lot of them are too young to have ever seen you pitch in person.
True. True. True.
I didn't mean that in a bad way.
No, I know. You got to call a spade a spade.
That's fact. I call them like I see them.
Right.
What can I do? Tommy, it was great to talk to you, and we'll see you at the Baseball Literature Conference on March 30th here at MTSU, okay?
You got it. I look forward to it. Thank you much.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.